When undocumented parents are deported, it can have long-lasting effects for their U.S.-born children who stay.
One of the things I hoped to accomplish with this story was to get people to start to think about mass deportation as a public policy and its impact on American communities.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, June 25th, we take a look at the high cost of deportations for U.S. families and communities. Also, how the passing of a historic bill in Georgia may raise the penalty for hate crimes in the state. But first, we break down how the racial justice uprising is changing our use of language, the way we recognize our identities, and who that actually serves. Ongoing protests for racial justice have started to shift the conversation around how we talk about race in the United States. And in some newsrooms, it's literally changing how journalists write about race and identity. Outlets including the Associated Press, the Los Angeles Times, and even us here at WNYC have started capitalizing the B when referring to Black people and culture. And that decision aligns with what Black media outlets have been doing for decades. The Associated Press also announced that they'll begin capitalizing the I in Indigenous when referring to Indigenous communities. Some outlets and many social media users have also started using the acronym BIPOC, which refers to Black people, Indigenous people, and people of color, and it's a term that's meant to affirm Black and Indigenous people and identity. But even that term has been criticized by some linguists and activists for homogenizing these different groups' experiences and erasing their individuality. How the media takes on language and identity in a time of social change? That's where we start today on The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Joining me now is Sandra E. Garcia, a reporter for the New York Times. Sandra, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also, we have Tristan Atone, editor-in-chief of the Texas Observer. Tristan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me also.
And John McWhorter is here with us as well. He's a linguistics professor at Columbia University and author of the book Words on the Move. Great to have you with us, John.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Well, we got a robust conversation, so let's get started. Sandra, you wrote a piece for the New York Times where you investigated the term BIPOC. Where did this come from?
Well, we don't really know, but it is widely used in Canada. It started being used on Twitter. The first instance that it was used was in 2013. But in Canada, they use BIPOC very commonly. They use it all the time. And that's because they feel like it's important to distinguish what Black people or descendants of Africans in Canada have been through and what Indigenous people in Canada have been through.
So, John, when we see emergence like by BIPOC, like terms like BIPOC and stylistic choices connected to social change, is that part of the natural evolution of language to start to see this? Because I'm thinking back to, you know, Hispanic and then Latino and then Latinx and sort of all of these phases that we go through. So what is your assessment of BIPOC right now?
Well, I think that it's an interesting new term. I'm not exactly sure that it was needed because, you know, every generation or two, these terms often are renewed because negative associations settle down upon them. And so Hispanic changes to Latino, Black changes to African American. People seek something that feels more positive and fresher. I'm not exactly sure what BIPOC responds to in that sense in terms of how people of color, you know, whatever that exactly is referring to, were feeling about being referred to as people of color. The Black issue seems to take us from African American back to Black, and I'm not sure how people feel about that. Then the Indigenous issue, there seem to be people who have problems with it, but language is about renewal. You don't sit and say the same things generation after generation after generation. The central aspect of why you open your mouth is because you wish to call someone's attention to something. And that often means refreshing terminology, and it's not surprising that that term has happened in these times in particular when we want each other's attention for so many reasons.
Tristan, you are an editor-in-chief. You are using a lot of these terms and making decisions about how these terms get played out, particularly in media. Tell us about your idea when it comes to BIPOC. Is it important to separate out, in for your editorial purposes, Black people and Indigenous people when referring to people of color?
Well, yeah, I mean, how we view and talk about ourselves is always changing, and it will continue to. I mean, what I want to see is accuracy. So I'm a Kiowa tribal member, and I want to be identified as such. But there is plenty of guidance offered by organizations like the Native American Journalists Association to help guide these conversations. And I think the more that journalism organizations sort of resist changes or are unable to sort of roll with the times, with language, the more it exposes the industry as being out of touch and out of date and often out anti-diversity.
So Tristan, to that point, and to John's point earlier, we've seen a lot of evolution of language right now. We're at this moment, a very big inflection point in this country. How do you, Tristan, as an editor, make the decision when it's appropriate to use a broad term like people of color versus something more specific?
Well, we speak with our staff. With BIPOC, we haven't used the term on a reporting at the moment. I'm sure it will come up at some point. But again, we strive for accuracy, and we strive to recruit reporters from those communities who know better when it comes to terminology and self-identification. It allows us to move with the conversation instead of making changes at a glacial pace. And essentially, that having those conversations and having a diverse staff helps keeps us current with readers and up to date and how we describe ourselves.
It's something that newsrooms across the country have been grappling with, is how to have that more diverse staff that is representative of the communities that they cover. Sandra, you wrote the piece for the New York Times, which is sort of putting a stake in the ground here about this term. But a lot of the people you talked to were actually critical of BIPOC. What did they see as some of the shortcomings of the phrase?
Well, I spoke to Sylvia O'Bell, who is a co-host on a Netflix podcast, OK Now Listen. She's an African-American. Actually, she's a Black person of Nigerian descent. And she felt that people should stop making decisions at best without asking Black people how they want to be referred to. Black people in the United States, African American people in the United States have been called a ton of things, and they have never been consulted on those things. And she just felt like BIPOC is a term that, like you said, homogenizes everyone, and it doesn't allow the person who is using this term to do the reading, basically, to take the time to learn about all the different backgrounds and everything that people have gone through. And just calling them BIPOC as is the same as saying the oppressed over there, you know, not white people. But it's important to distinguish who we are talking about. Same with Chelsea Luger, who is a wellness trainer at a wellness center. And she is also a member of a tribe. And she felt that the term is, you know, on the heels of colonization, because it erases what people have gone through, what Black people have gone through, Indigenous people have gone through. And with the POC, it just groups just everyone of color when we all have different backgrounds, different ways that we have been oppressed. And so they're not pretty keen on using a term that just bunches everyone together and keeps people from doing the work that's necessary to learn about the different types of oppression that they have experienced.
Well, and I want to sort of drill down a little bit on that point about the other sort of POC box, right? Because that seems to be also at issue here. John, when you hear terms like people of color, I mean, this term, as far as I remember, was sort of something that came into the fore to represent this. I think back to Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition, where, you know, we sort of all are in this group of non-white people. That term itself has evolved, and there are people who don't want to be associated with people of color. How do you think that, how much do you think these terms matter to the communities they're actually referring to, John?
Well, to be honest, I think there's often a disconnect between the conversations that we have, you know, the media people, academic people, college town people, and other people, where labels evolve in perhaps a more organic fashion and aren't looked at with such fine distinction. But people of color, you know, last time I heard, that wasn't good enough because it didn't individualize various people of color enough, and it sounded ominously like colored. And so, yeah, there's some problems there. But then I also worry about this idea that the new term BIPOC is wrong because it doesn't individualize enough, because I think it's natural to language that we genericize to an extent. So we say plant, and we're not talking about roses versus, you know, daffodils versus maple trees. I'm not sure that we can make an exception for that when it comes to groups of human beings. And so, for example, there is a marvelous array of indigenous / Native American communities in North and South America, so many different communities. But I wonder if it's possible to have a way of referring to all of them that also gets in the individuality. We have to generalize to an extent. But then again, I get the feeling these are conversations that we're having here that often are quite different from the conversations that the vast majority of people involved in the name are having, or frankly, even though I'm indulging in the conversation myself, that even consider significant. And so I think we just need to remember that we're having a kind of MSM conversation as opposed to a conversation about everybody else.
I have to say, I agree. I think there are conversations that are happening on social media and among the media ourselves that really are not, when I bring those issues to folks that aren't in the media, they're like, what are you talking about?
Right.
But I do want to backtrack a little bit here to Tristan's point for a minute. And Sandra, get your thoughts on this, because Tristan, you mentioned that, you know, the specificity and the accuracy of really understanding a tribal name or affiliation is important in reporting. And then Sandra, you mentioned the sort of POC as a catch-all, right, for non-Black, non-Indigenous folks. But here's the question. I mean, there are also Black people who are not African American, who are they're also Latinos, right, who have specific country of origin. So how specific, Sandra, do we want to start to get in terms of our origins to get away from the POC term?
Right. I think that we should be extremely specific. And it also depends on how people want to be referred to, right? So I'm a Black woman, but I'm also Dominican. In this country, when I say I'm a Black woman, people assume I'm African American. And I think that that assumption happens not only because of the way I look, but also because of the way these terms are used here in this country. I think we should call people what they want to be called and talk to them about how they want to be called. I do think that the term people of color erases our culture, right? And while I am a Black woman, there are certain things and certain cultural things that I don't experience or have never done, my family has never been through, because they're not African American. And I think that distinction is important. It's important for me to say, you know what, yes, I understand this, but it's not something that my family has ever been exposed to. I do think that POC does the work academically and in media circles, but it is a lazy term, if you ask me.
There have been a lot of recent changes here, specifically when it comes to capitalizing the B in Black and the I in Indigenous. Tristan, from your perspective, how important has it been for you to capitalize the I in Indigenous?
Well, at the Native American Journalists Association, we've been fighting for the capitalization of Indigenous for about 5 years. We've argued that Indigenous is an identity like Black and not an adjective, and that the term should be capitalized to avoid confusion between plants, animals, and human beings. So it is really a big deal that the AP style book has caught up with the rest of the globe. You know, capitalizing Indigenous has been common practice in everywhere from Canada and Australia and New Zealand, for instance. So we're happy to see that these changes are being made, and that this recognition is finally coming about after so many years of fighting for it.
Why was it such a fight, though, Tristan? I mean, the explanation you just gave me seems pretty straightforward as to why it should be capitalized.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's fair.
I think that journalism organizations are often moving at a pace that are out of sync with the actual conversations that people are having. I mean, journalists of color make up nearly 23% of newsrooms or so, and that number has been more or less stagnant over the years. I think the simplest explanation to why the situation exists is that newsrooms are often actively opposed to any sort of diversity.
Sandra, the B in black is now being capitalized because the AP had made that decision, and we know newspapers tend to fall in line and follow AP style. The New York Times does have its own style guide. So is the Times capitalizing the B in black? And more broadly, what's your assessment of how significant the decision to capitalize B in black is right now?
I'm not sure if the Times is capitalizing the B in black. We have a standards team that deals with that. I'm sure the conversation is being had, especially now that the AP has changed its style. I do think that the conversation around capitalizing B in black is important because, like I said earlier, black people, African-American people in this country have been called all sorts of names, and they have never been consulted. And this seems to be the first time that as a group together, they're okay with what they want to be called, which is black, and they want to be capitalized. And so I do think it's an important conversation, just like we would respect what someone wants to be considered, you know, how they want their gender considered, just how we would respect that someone identifies as a non-binary or anything like that. We should respect what people want to be called and how they want to be called. So I think the conversation is extremely important.
John, in terms of the use of capitalization in both of these terms, do you see that as a significant move?
No. I don't have any problem. I don't have any problem with it. I mean, it feels natural to me. I've always kind of wanted to capitalize it myself because it refers to a group of people with an identity and a history. And so, sure, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to capitalize the B, good, I'll happily go along with it. I've always liked black as a term better than African-American, but that's a whole different rant. But nobody ever had a problem with capitalizing African-American because Africa comes with a capital letter already. But to be honest, and this is me toggling between my jolly linguist and quote-unquote contrarian race self, honestly, I think I'm more interested in ending the war on drugs and reforming the cops than in capitalizing a letter. I understand that surfaces matter. I understand that gestures matter. But in this case, sure, let's capitalize the B. I will read the Times every morning and I will enjoy seeing that capital letter. But it's the more substantial things that I think will really help change how race works in America. And I know that sounds so curmudgeonly. I'm sorry. But yeah, I'm a language person. I like capital letters too. But frankly, it's the society that I'm more interested in changing as opposed to issues of orthography.
Tristan, this week, NAJA, the Native American Journalists Association, along with a number of other journalist associations, published a statement calling on news outlets to stop publishing the names and images of race-based sports mascots. We know there is one in particular that we here on The Takeaway do not call by name. Have any other outlets made changes based on that statement yet?
As far as we know, no. And I think this speaks to John's point as well in looking at what those bigger changes can be. NAJA has been joined by the National Association of Black Journalists, National Association of Hispanic Journalists, Asian American Journalists Association, and even the Society of Professional Journalists to call for that discontinuance. Where we sit on this is that it's a matter of ethics. Journalists have a say in using racist language. They shouldn't wait for those teams to change their names or logos in order to stop using that racist language. And there's no reason that reporters in 2020 are still referring to indigenous people by racist slurs from the 18th century.
Are you satisfied with the way that that particular team and others are being reported on so far?
No. Again, using those racist terms, racist terminology and logos are incredibly hurtful to people, and they are outright racist. Journalists do have a say in this, but obviously hiding behind the idea of objectivity a lot comes with continuing to reprint those images and words.
Sandra E. Garcia is a reporter for The New York Times. Tristan Ottone is editor-in-chief at the Texas Observer. And John McWhorter is a linguistics professor at Columbia University. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
On Tuesday, Georgia lawmakers passed the state's first hate crimes legislation, which raises the penalty for crimes committed because of someone's race, sex, gender, religion, national origin, or disability. The recent killings of Ahmaud Arbery and of Rashard Brooks, two unarmed black men, spurred lawmakers to take the issue back up after it had repeatedly stalled in past years. The new law coincides with the Georgia grand jury's decision to indict the three white men suspected of killing Ahmaud Arbery in February on murder charges. And yet another bill was passed this week that offers similar penalties to any crimes committed against police officers and other first responders. Here with us now is Maya Prabhu, a State House reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Maya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lot going on in the Georgia State House. Let's start with the new hate crime legislation, which is expected to be signed by Governor Kemp. What exactly are the penalties that people would face for hate crimes?
The penalties depend on if it's a misdemeanor or a felony. So if it's one of five misdemeanors, which are simple assault, simple battery, battery, criminal trespass, or misdemeanor theft, they could face an additional penalty of between 6 and 12 months and up to $5,000 fine, in addition to the sentence that they receive for whatever the crime is that they committed. So in Georgia, our hate crimes law will be a sentencing enhancement and not a standalone crime. And then if it's a felony and you're convicted or you're found to have committed a hate crime, you would get at least 2 years additional to your sentence and up to a $5,000 fine.
Maya, if Governor Kemp signs this, Georgia is just one of four states, including Arkansas, Wyoming, and South Carolina, that so far did not have anti-hate crime legislation on the books. What was the thing that got them to revisit this? I mean, was it the Ahmaud Arbery killing? Was it Rashard Brooks? Is it the ongoing racial justice uprising across the country, or a combination of all those things?
I do believe it was a combination of all of those things. We had a hate crimes law on the books that passed in 2000. But in 2004, the Supreme Court found it to be unconstitutionally vague. And part of that is because when the bill was initially introduced in 2000, it included the protected classes of race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation. In 2000, it seems there were several lawmakers who were uncomfortable with providing protections based on sexual orientation. And so they changed the language to say if someone is convicted of a crime that was motivated by bias or prejudice. And in 2004, the Georgia Supreme Court said that was too vague. So they've come back pretty much every year since then, introduced legislation that would increase penalties for hate crimes, because that was what the 2000 law was. It was also a sentencing enhancement. And every year, it might get a hearing, it might not. In 2017, a law was introduced. In 2018, it didn't get a hearing. In 2019, when this law that passed earlier this week was introduced, it received a hearing. It made it out of the House in March of 2019, and then it made it over to the Senate, and it just sat there. And it didn't get a hearing. You know, I spoke with lawmakers in charge of making the decisions about what bills get heard. There was no interest in hearing this bill in January. We go on break because of coronavirus, and during that time, the video of Ahmaud Arbery goes viral, and then Rayshard Brooks we had here in Atlanta a few weeks ago. And so listening to the floor debate, a lot of these lawmakers, Republican lawmakers who were against the idea of hate crimes legislation, said, you know, before seeing these killings on video, I didn't feel there was a need for enhanced penalties. I thought crimes were crimes, but seeing these videos let me know that there is hate out there and it needs to be addressed.
Maya, one of the things that we're seeing playing out across the country is also an increased call for protections for first responders, but specifically for police officers. And that's a big national debate that's happening. But in Georgia, the assembly also passed a bill that offers similar penalties for any crimes committed against police officers and other first responders. How is that going to be implemented?
So this legislation, it creates a new offense called bias motivated intimidation against a first responder. So police, paramedic, firefighter. So if someone commits the offense, if there's death, serious bodily harm or property damage of at least $500, they can be charged with bias motivated intimidation and could serve between 1 and 5 years in prison and pay up to $5,000 in a fine. And the way that this came about is it was initially inserted into hate crimes legislation on Friday. Democrats, supporters of hate crime legislation, were infuriated by that move. And over the weekend, I guess lawmakers continued to negotiate, make compromises. And the compromise that was reached was to remove protections for police from the hate crimes legislation and put it in its own separate bill. Now, the hate crimes bill passed with bipartisan support, overwhelming support in both chambers. And this other bill that gives protections to police passed on mostly a party line vote and narrowly in the House. Another part of that, it also allows police officers to sue someone if they knowingly file a false complaint against them.
Are these two pieces of legislation essentially comparable, Maya, in your opinion or in your analysis here? Because or did police and first responders walk away here with much more solid protections and a much more clear line, should we say, than what the hate crimes bill in Georgia would be proposing for those protections?
There was nothing in the hate crimes law that would allow victims to sue, which was something that our lieutenant governor here said that he very much wanted to see in the law. It didn't make it into the final compromise, the final legislation. Allowing police officers to sue if someone complains against them and it's a false complaint, that's not something that Democratic lawmakers who I spoke with after that bill passed say that that's not a right that is given to anyone else. Because the example that I was given was from the bill, it doesn't appear to matter whether or not the complaint was filed against the police officer while he or she was acting in an official capacity. So the example I was given was if a police officer is committing domestic violence against his wife, and his wife goes to his chief, police chief, and says, "Hey, you know, my husband is harming me. Can you talk to him?" That's a complaint. And he can therefore turn around and sue her and say that you're lying. Whether or not the case comes out in his favor, the worry that Democrats have is that it'll be a chilling effect on people lodging complaints against the police.
Maya Prabhu is a State House reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Maya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Two years ago, the Trump administration began the process of separating thousands of migrant parents from their children at the U.S.-Mexico border. But within the United States itself, family separation continues, with undocumented parents being deported to countries many of them haven't been to in years.
What good came out of my husband being deported? And is the country a safer place? What good came out of it?
That's Celeste Hernandez, whose husband Pedro was deported to Mexico by the U.S. government in 2017, despite having a green card application in the pipeline. The Trump administration considered Pedro a, quote, repeat immigration offender, having crossed the U.S. border 3 times without the proper documentation. and that triggered a visit from immigration officials who then deported him. Losing her husband meant Celeste also lost a critical source of income for the family, something that happens to many mixed-status families when the main breadwinner is deported.
Only thing that I know is me, the boys, my kids, our friends, the family sits in disbelief, struggling, unnecessary struggle, unnecessary suffering of the separation, unnecessary worry.
Celeste's family is not alone. An analysis from the Marshall Project and the Center for Migration Studies shows that about 6 million American children in the United States live with at least one undocumented family member at risk of being deported. And today, the Supreme Court sided with the Trump administration to quickly deport some immigrants in the United States without seeing a judge. Julia Preston is a contributing writer for the Marshall Project, and she interviewed Celeste and two other families.
We tried to show how broad the scope is of the families that could be subject to deportation. There are 6 million American citizen children in the United States who have a parent who is undocumented and could be deported. We found that when a breadwinner is taken out of a family, the income of a family drops by almost half. So the economic impact on these families is potentially devastating. And we know from Immigration and Customs Enforcement that just in 5 years, up to 2018, more than 230,000 parents who were deported said they had U.S. citizen children. So our purpose here was to really focus on the impact on American families and American children of these deportations, this devastating, lasting impact.
A lot of times when we talk about undocumented folks who are here in this country, we refer to them as this mass of millions of people. But your work, you went and really profiled three families for the story in Ohio. We're about to hear some audio from Talia Moctezuma, whose mother Esperanza was deported to Mexico. And here's Talia describing some of the immediate feelings she had when her mother was taken away.
The house was just like, it didn't have like that vibe that my mom would give to it. Like, it was just so like, it felt cold, it felt dark. Like, there wasn't just like, we needed my mom there, and we still do to this day. Like, I still feel that vibe where it's like cold and like, it's just dark. When they said that she's getting on a plane and that she's leaving, like, that just like, it hurt really, really bad. I felt like that shouldn't happen, because like, if they're taking a mother away from a child, like, the child should at least like hug her, say her goodbyes, like something. And it just, I was so like angry at like the whole system.
Julia Esperanza had four daughters. One of them was Talia, who were left in the United States. What do we know about the psychological effects that Esperanza's deportation had on her children?
These four American teenagers were cast adrift. Their father is a very loving man, but he had to work just to keep the family afloat. And he could rarely be home. And over the course of 2 years after Esperanza was deported, two of her younger daughters tried to commit suicide. In one instance, Esperanza was actually on the WhatsApp video in Mexico with Talia, as one of her daughters was unconscious in a suicide attempt. And Esperanza had to talk her daughter through the process of saving this girl's life and getting her to an ambulance and getting a relative to take her to the hospital. And then it happened again. These young girls just felt so bereft that their mother, who had been a very hands-on, very loving and caring mother, had been deported and was separated from them.
You can hear a lot of that in Talia's voice when she speaks to you. Julia, you also write about Alfredo Ramos and his family. What happened when Alfredo was deported to Mexico?
Alfredo was a case of an immigrant who self-deported. So ICE started to come after him after many years. Alfredo never had a criminal record. He had been a very good and caring father, and he'd been in the United States for decades. And after he was a target for ICE, he decided to leave on his own so that he would have some prospect of coming back to be with his kids someday. And in León, Guanajuato, about a year after he left the United States, he was gunned down, shot 27 times on a street in Mexico in what the police in Mexico determined was a case of mistaken identity. The gunmen left a note indicating that they thought that he was a rival trafficker. And so two American citizen children, both of whom are really superstar kids, have lost their father, again, for no discernible benefit.
Julie, I want to play more audio that you shared with us. This is an interview with Celeste Hernandez, whose husband was deported to Mexico. Let's take a listen.
I'm a prisoner in my own home, and we live a personal hell. This is awful because there's no reason for this to be going on. The man did everything. So basically everything he worked for was to make himself legal, an American. And we did it and we did it. And, you know, working 7 days a week, both of us paying and paying and paying. I was like, well, one day this is going to be okay. All of this is going to be okay. We're getting there. We're getting there. We're getting there. Boom. Get out. And I'm left to put the pieces together.
It's hard to listen to that tape without getting emotional. Julia, tell us about Celeste Hernandez and her son Juan and the economic impact of her husband's deportation.
Celeste's son Juan is 30 years old. He was born with a severe cerebral palsy. He is in a wheelchair. He can't talk. He can't feed himself or move without care. And when Pedro Hernandez was in Ohio with Celeste, he traded off the care of this disabled son so that both of them could work. And one of the things that you hear from Celeste in that clip is how close they were to actually getting a legal status and a green card for Pedro. They had been married. He had been checking in with ICE. He had an approved green card. They were just waiting for the last step of his process to become a legal permanent resident when the Trump administration decided to deport him. Now Celeste can't work. She's at home all the time, taking care of her son. And they have also a son named Luis, who's now 11 years old. This is Pedro and Celeste's son together. He is missing his father. And their entire communication with Pedro, who's now in Acapulco, Mexico, is via WhatsApp when there's Wi-Fi where Pedro lives. And so this is just, this family is devastated for no reason, really, that I could discern. And it's not just the damage to the family, but in this case, there was also a shift of this family, hardworking family, never wanted to take public benefits. Now Celeste is entirely dependent on public benefits.
So Julia, how do these deportations play into the larger pattern of the Trump administration's immigration policies?
This is family separation on a massive scale and much more enduring than the family separation policy that we saw with the Trump administration at the border in 2018. These are families that are separated in a permanent and very devastating way. And one of the things I hope to accomplish with this story was to get people to start to think about mass deportation as a public policy and its impact on American communities. We're not talking about border enforcement anymore with these stories. We're talking about what we call mixed status families. There are millions of children in the United States who have a parent who could be subject to this deportation. And the long-term impacts are not dissimilar to what we have talked about in communities that have experienced mass incarceration. And so I'm hoping that with this story that we can start to also talk about the aftermath of mass deportation, which is still going on and has been going on for many years in this country.
Julia, to that point, part of that, those deportations under the Obama administration, one of the things that he was criticized about most by immigrant activists and Latinos more broadly was just his take on deportations. What's different now than what happened under the Obama administration?
At the end of the Obama administration, President Obama was making an effort to focus deportation on serious criminals, people who posed real national security threats. And when President Trump took office, he eliminated the rules that created those priorities. And now under President Trump, any person who is out of immigration status can be deported. In the three cases that I wrote about, in all three cases, they had been given dispensation and the possibility of fixing their status in some fashion under President Obama. And President Trump took that opportunity away and decided to deport them instead. And so even though President Trump's overall numbers of deportations are not as high as the peak years of President Obama, the numbers of people who are being deported who have no serious criminal record at all or and pose no threat to public safety, those numbers are going up every year.
Julia Preston is a contributing writer for the Marshall Project covering immigration. Julia, thanks so much for your work.
Thank you for speaking with me.
We know that these conversations can be heavy, folks. The news these days is very heavy. And at this moment in history, we're probably all struggling with what we're hearing and seeing every day. So to round out the show, we want to hear from you on the things and even the very small things that are bringing you joy.
This is Bernadette from Portland, Oregon. The current climate of the world is so chaotic between COVID and the very justified protests top everything else. I'm a new mom with postpartum. It's very hard to find joy, I feel. However, my beautiful baby, whenever they smile, that brings a lot of joy.
This is Marilyn from Denver, Colorado, and I'm calling to say Lady Gaga helped me through my husband's death and the coronavirus problem that we're having. And I walk every day to her new record, Chromatica, and I love her music. It keeps me going, and I'm flailing my arms in the air. I walk. I'm sure people think I'm a lunatic, but it keeps me joyful and has gotten me through some pretty dark times.
Hello, my name is Sean Hilson. I'm calling from Ithaca, New York. I have a four-year-old daughter, and I've been learning a lot of songs to sing to her when we go on bike rides. So one of the songs I sing for her is the Beatles' Let It Be. I just want to sing a verse. When all the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer. Let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance they will see. There will be an answer. Let it be.
Thanks so much for calling. And remember, you can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and share your thoughts with us on anything we've discussed on the show. And before we head out today, I want to give a quick shout out to the team that helps put this show together every day. Our board operators, Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry, were in the studio at WNYC alongside director Vince Fairchild with remote assistance from director and editor Jay Cowett. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. Our producers are Jackie Martin, Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Dina Syed Ahmed, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Holly Arungu is our digital editor. Katarina Barton is our intern, and David Gable is our administrative assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. I'm Tanzina Vega. Until next week, thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.